clean, freshly painted. Fresh air circulates through every 6 minutes. It's a lovely place, but I don't like it. We would like you to stop by sometime and take a look, and I'm sure that your opinion would be other than mine. I kind of stand alone in this. Next of all, I'd like to remind you, too, that Phil Walker appears with his incomparable Switzerland in just 2 weeks. In this, you will see an exciting episode where he crosses the Swiss Alps in a balloon. Now, this was written up recently in National Geographic, and we might say that Phil Walker rose to this high adventure. I didn't have anything prepared to say tonight, you see. But also, as you know, Switzerland is an extremely popular box office subject, and the advance sales have been tremendous. So if you have any friends who are interested, we urge you to suggest to them they get their tickets as soon as possible. Some of you have been coming to World Cavalcade for a great number of years, and you know that we have certain speakers appear year after year after year. And these are the top-notch men in the field. You've come to know them personally, recognize their trademarks. However, World Cavalcade does constantly bring to you new personalities. I don't know of any year in the past 7 that we haven't introduced at least 1 new personality. This year we have 3, 2 this evening and 1 next March. Next year we have 2. And I'm sure that you will enjoy them a great deal. And I want to point out that we keep vigilant and keep an eye out for these people that we believe come up to World Cavalcade standards. Now, the 2 young ladies you will see this evening are presenting their 2nd film. This is the 2nd film they have ever made. However, don't mistake me, they've made a lot of films for commercial organizations. And we think this is pretty unusual that they have achieved such eminence and distinction throughout the United States and Canada. Mrs. Saunders caught their show up in Canada a couple of years ago and said, they are good and we must have them. I won't tell you too much about them because they have a very cute little introduction about themselves. All I'll say is that Lisa Chickering is part of the Chickering piano family, and Jeannie Porterfield is part of the Porterfield family that operated the Barter Theater in the East. And Lisa had studied for the concert stage and has been a concert singer appearing throughout the world. Jeannie was a professional actress, and now they're making films and showing them to such wonderful audiences as World Cavalcade. Ladies and gentlemen, Jeannie Porterfield and Lisa Chickering.
Good evening, everyone. It certainly is nice to be here in Seattle with you tonight.
I can't tell you how much it means to us. First of all, Seattle is our very favorite city in this country. And now, with this beautiful theater, this is our favorite theater in the country. So we're very happy. And you know, since being here in Seattle, so many people have been asking us just how the two of us ever did get started making travel films. Well, now you might say that interest in the world and travel started at a rather early age.
It certainly did. As children, Lisa and I lived near each other in Chicago, and I remember one time somebody said that China was right under Chicago.
I remember that, too. In fact, I also remember that we immediately proceeded to dig up the backyard in search of it. Well, now, needless to say, China wasn't reached that time, although some years later it was.
Only not via the backyard. Lisa was a singer and had a singing engagement in Paris and asked me if I'd like to go along. Well, the answer was yes, as I'd always wanted to go to Europe.
So had I. And this tour, which was to last, approximately 4 weeks, turned into a 3-year trip around the world.
And all this time we photographed everything we saw, from the Eiffel Tower to wild monkeys in India to chop suey in China. Then, arriving back in the United States,
which, as I said, turned out to be 3 long years later,
we found we had more interesting pictures than anything else.
So that's when we decided to go back to some of our favorite places in the world and make these films.
And tonight we're so glad to be able to show you our film on the Dutch area of the Caribbean.
Caribbean? Well, now, there's a slight difference of opinion here. You know how we all have our own ways of pronouncing certain words? Well, now, for instance, I say either.
And I say either. And needless to say, we have the same differences with neither and neither, too.
Well, now, these differences of pronunciation don't affect you too much. But I'm afraid our next one does. I say Caribbean.
And I say Caribbean. And since neither one of us can come to an agreement on
Since both are equally used and equally acceptable, this evening you're going to the Caribbean with Jean and to the Caribbean with me. Now, just in case you might be wondering how two people are going to narrate this one film, do you know that's very easily solved? I'm leaving.
But she'll be back to take you on the second half of our Caribbean trip. Now, if your bags are packed, we'll start. But first, just a word about the territory we're going to. When one thinks of the Netherlands, we tend to picture just little Holland. But actually, there's quite a bit more to it than that. The Kingdom of the Netherlands contains not only Holland, but extends into our part of the world, to the Caribbean, to include the six islands of the Dutch West Indies and the country of Suriname in South America. Since Indonesia and more recently New Guinea are no longer a part of the Netherlands, these six islands and Suriname, where we're going this evening, now comprise the entire Kingdom of the Netherlands outside of Holland. So now let's see our tropical touch of the Dutch. Trip we had planned to travel light, but somewhere those plans went astray. Luckily, a most obliging man from the airlines offered to help us with all those last-minute things one thinks of to take along. Little did he know the feat he had undertaken. Well, that was an easy boarding for us. Our huge jet soared off, and once in the air, our Dutch treat began. We settled down to enjoy the steady stream of delicacies that appeared almost every mile of the 1900 we had before reaching our destination. You know, this was the kind of flight that made me think it would be just as much fun to keep on flying rather than getting back down to Earth in more ways than one. The first part of our trip is to the three most important islands of the Dutch West Indies, known as the ABC Islands. The three Windward Islands to the northeast and the country of Suriname you'll see in the second half of the program. As for the ABCs, instead of starting in alphabetical order, we're going to work backwards and start with the center island of the group, Curaçao. Curaçao is the largest and most important island of all six of them, as it's the seat of the government for all of them. Now the Dutch West Indies, or Netherlands Antilles, as they're officially called, form an independent part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands. Before 1954, they were colonies belonging to Holland. But in that year, Queen Juliana gave them their autonomy, making them self-governing and on a basis of equality with the Netherlands. Well, after a most glamorous flight, we reached Curaçao and anxiously anticipated what lay before us. Luckily, another unsuspecting Dutchman offered to help us. But this I'm sure he didn't anticipate, nor did we anticipate the strong trade winds. This is certainly no place to wear one of those new fashionable wigs. With what coiffures we had left, we took the bus into town. Willemstad is the capital, in fact, the only real city of Curacao. And what a surprise it is to find down here in the tropics the colorful Dutch waterfront reflecting the quaint charm of Holland. One of the most memorable features of Willemstad is this unique swinging bridge, fondly called Queen Emma, after the present Queen Juliana's grandmother. This most restless of bridges connects the two main sections of town, one side being called the Punda, the other the Otrabaan. It's constantly opening for the many people, or for the many boats that come and go, and there's always considerable hurrying and scurrying when the opening signal is given. If the cars don't make it over the bridge, it's a 15-mile drive around to get to the other side. Well, you know, they really have a good excuse here for being late. These people, it seems, got caught in the middle, but most of the pedestrians take the busy little ferry boats that shuttle back and forth while the bridge is in operation. A clock estimates the time the bridge will close and the traffic can cross over again. Curaçao is the Caribbean's busiest port, with a steady flow of ships streaming right through the very heart of town, dwarfing the streets and gabled rooftops. Well, you know, I'm not sure who has the right of way in a situation like this. Overlooking the waterfront is the harbor pilot's office, and here the pilots receive their orders as to the ships they're to bring in and take out. One of the most experienced pilots is Jan Feenstra, on his way here to bring in a cargo ship. Now watch the impeccable Dutch. The cargo ship's waiting for him just outside the harbor entrance. There are 18 harbor pilots in all, each usually bringing in an average of 2 to 3 ships a day. Because of the tides, ocean currents, and narrow, restrictive harbor entrance, it takes a great deal of experience to pilot in the big ships. In fact, under Dutch law, a harbor pilot must have earned various certificates that even qualify him to be a sea captain himself. Although the captain is responsible in all ways for his ship, when a harbor pilot is on board, he takes over command. And as ships come to Curaçao from all parts of the world, he must be able to give his commands in at least 8 languages. Although Curaçao is only 38 miles long and 7 at its widest, it's the world's 4th largest harbor in tonnage of ships using it. Coming in this way, you can see the leading hotel, built within the remaining walls of an old fort, and the Dutch waterfront slipping by is a sight travelers rarely forget. The narrow channel Jan is now guiding the ship along opens into a huge inner harbor where the Dutch Shell oil refinery is. This is the world's 2nd largest oil refinery and was established here due to Curaçao's proximity to Venezuela, where the crude oil comes from. The refinery has brought great prosperity to the island and is one of the most important factors in its economy, giving employment to thousands. Having completed his job, Jan crosses back over to the Punda side to await another call. The Punda is the oldest section where the main shops and businesses are located, as well as many important buildings of historical interest. The Protestant church, dating back to the mid-1700s, is an excellent example of Dutch colonial architecture. And here in the same square is the old Fort Amsterdam. The Dutch first came to Curaçao in 1634. They took the island from the far-reaching Spanish, who had settled here after discovering it in 1499. Despite several attacks by the French and British and a few short periods of British rule, Holland has managed to keep the island down through the centuries, with Curaçao now, as I said, an independent part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands. The yellow building is one of the oldest synagogues in the Western Hemisphere. It, too, dates back to the mid-1700s. Although gone for many years, the influence of the Spanish still persists, with narrow little streets and picturesque alleyways, accompanied by long Dutch names. Not one of which I'd try to pronounce. The younger face of Curaçao is seen in such things as their post office and modern war memorial. You know, with so many of our United States dollars going to the four corners of the world, we taxpayers should appreciate this American consulate as it was given to us by the people of Curaçao in gratitude for our protection of them during World War II. The houses of Curaçao are another of its memorable qualities. Their style and ornamentation are strictly Curaçaoan, and even their color presents an unusual story. Legend says that a Dutch governor once complained that the glare of the sun on the white houses gave him headaches. Well, when reminded that he was the governor, he promptly passed a law that no more houses could be painted white. Well, that's quite a cure for a headache. Here's an appropriate name for a flower shop. And from the looks of this house, a Picasso or Dali might live here. It's fascinating to wander around looking at all these rainbow-hued houses. But don't be surprised if one looks right back at you. In seeing all the various houses, we came to the one where the harbor pilot, Jan Feenstra, lives with his wife and family. Both Jan and his wife, Jantje, are from Holland and were married there 13 years ago. Now Jan says what a joy it is to be able to come home after a day's work, instead of the way it used to be for the first 5 years while he was away at sea most of the time. While he was an officer on a Dutch Shell oil ship that kept coming to Curaçao, he decided he'd like to make their home here. Well, that was 8 years ago, and they've all been happily here ever since. Just off the main waterway in a small lagoon is the picturesque floating market. Schooners from South America line up here by the dozens to sell fresh fruit and vegetables right from their decks. It's here where Jantje, the harbor pilot's wife, likes to do some of her marketing. As Curaçao has a very dry climate, little food can be grown on its arid land. So much of it comes from Venezuela, which is just 38 miles to the south. Jan and Jantje always enjoy shopping for the many bargains that are available here. And of course, so do the many tourists who come here from all parts of the world. One of the main shopping streets is the mall, where even a donkey could find something to buy if he were so inclined. Everyone's most anxious to fill up their shopping bags, but seem a bit confused as to just which direction to proceed in, which store to go to. And when they find another store, do they have any money left to buy just one more thing? We, too, are unable to resist the lure of shopping and headed for one of the finest jewelry stores. Business in Curaçao is conducted in 22 languages, and the currency of any country is accepted, so the language barrier doesn't exist here. But after enough shopping, neither does your currency. The diamond rings in this box alone came to over $250,000. And wouldn't you know, the first one that I pointed to is the most expensive one there, $42,000. They didn't know that we were just looking. Many of these exquisite pieces would sell for 30% more here in the United States. Now I know why they say diamonds are a girl's best friend. Nowhere else in the Caribbean is there such a great range of lovely items to be had at bargain prices. The bargains exist because the import duty is so low here, especially on many of these lovely luxury items that come from all corners of the globe. One of the things strictly from here is their own world-famous Curaçao liqueur, made from the peel of the little green oranges grown on the island. On the outskirts of Willemstad is a Curaçao museum, another fine example of Dutch colonial architecture. Built originally as a military hospital, it now houses many interesting things from the colonial period. ...56% of the island's budget goes for education. And this is one of their finest schools, the Peter Stuyvesant College. The word college here actually means high school. Curaçao has one of the highest rates of literacy in the entire Caribbean. Peter Stuyvesant was the first governor here back in the mid-1600s and is still fondly remembered. Colorful flame trees dot the landscape along the road leading to the picturesque Piscadera Beach Club, situated a few miles outside of town on the water. This is not only a favorite place for the tourists to stay and relax, but also where the Curaçaoans themselves like to spend much of their free time. Jan, too, every chance he gets, brings the whole family here to spend the day. The two older children, Robert, 12, and Willia, 10, were born in Holland. Little Mika, age 4, was born here. But now all of them, including Jan and Jantje, feel that this is home, and more than thrive on Curaçao's wonderful climate, where the sun dips behind the rain clouds a scant 20 days out of the year at the most. The children, as all children everywhere, are more than anxious to get into the water. And if they had their way about it, they'd stay in all day long. But Jan, as most dutiful parents, has other ideas about it, especially for the youngest member of the family who's just learning to swim. But in this case, the smallest turns out to be the mightiest. She even proves to be the victor of the day by keeping the whole family in the water until they were finally forced to leave, but only because the sun did. Boca Tabla on the windward side of the island is a huge cave. Here the timeless waves, which present quite another facet of the Caribbean, have pounded against the coral rock to carve out the formation. Sailing is another popular recreation here, and it seems as though little Mika doesn't want to miss the boat. Jan, on his day away from piloting in the big ships, takes a proverbial busman's holiday and sails his own boat in a picturesque bay known as Spanish Water. Jan also likes to build model ships and is even in the process of building a small boat for his son. Back in his native Holland, Jan's father wanted him to go into business and thought his love of the sea just a passing fancy. But with Jan, this was a fancy that certainly didn't pass. The countryside is called the Kanuku, and here hundreds of wild goats have smugly taken possession of the land, haughtily regarding the people as the trespassers. Here, too, stately plantations still stand, dating from the colonial days. They contrast sharply with the thatched-roofed huts of the few people still living in the sparsely populated Kanuku. The majority of the island's 129,000 people live in Willemstad. Folk customs and dances are usually better preserved in the rural areas than towns, and this group's enjoying themselves in a typical Curaçaoan dance of a most abandoned, congenial nature. Did I say congenial? Varied styles of dancing brought to the island by the many seafarers of the past. Well, after that dance, a well-earned rest before heading down the road back to town, where they often perform at the hotel. That one's really putting his heart into it. The hotel is situated right at the entrance to the waterway, and because the ships pass by so close to it, you can almost reach out and touch them. It's the only hotel possessing collision insurance. It's ingeniously built within the remaining walls of an old fort. Passengers from the cruise ships come to see this unique hotel, and also to see the dancers who've come in to perform for them. Nassau, the oldest fort, is built high up on a hilltop. It's now used as a signal tower for the ships, as it can be so easily seen from its vantage point. The harbor pilots down below watch for the various signals, each having their own meaning. And when the black ball is up, accompanied by a red flag, it means that the bridge is open and a ship is about to leave. And what a famous ship it is, the Portuguese Santa Maria, and Jan is the pilot to take her out. It was the same time of day in January 1961 that an amazing story was enacted. Right here in Willemstad, a group of Portuguese men peacefully boarded, but a little outside of the port, they hijacked the ship in a rebellion against their government. They were the first pirates of contemporary times, and the plight of the Santa Maria became world headlines. Then as now, this same captain, Captain Maia, was in command, and he was forced at gunpoint to surrender the Santa Maria to the rebel leader, Gavao. Somehow, Gavao managed to keep this 20,000-ton luxury liner hidden at sea. And as many of its 600 passengers were Americans, even the United States Navy joined in the search. Finally, 13 days later, Gavao was forced to surrender the Santa Maria at the Brazilian port of Recife. Since then, many articles and books have been written about this daring, unforgettable incident. When the rope ladder is lowered and Jan is back in the pilot boat, his job is complete, and he sends the Santa Maria on her way. Safely, we trust this time. Curaçao is certainly a port that Captain Maia will never forget, and nor will we, but for many more pleasant reasons. And no matter how one leaves, it's always fun to look back and see that little bit of Holland in the Caribbean. Second in size of the ABCs, but third in importance, is the island of Bonaire. It's only 40 miles east of Curaçao, but what a change in the weather! The mystery of the barren trees, drifting snowflakes and snowbanks? Well, it's mere wind-whipped salt foam and piles of sparkling salt. So Bonaire is a tropic isle after all. It's a quiet, sleepy island devoid of any commercial activity, where its 6,000 inhabitants really enjoy being off the beaten track. In fact, the tranquility of the island is its main tourist attraction today. But you know, I often wonder, with many tourists, then what happens to that tranquility? Kralendijk, the peaceful little capital, has the air of a colonial settlement, as in the days when the Dutch first came here. The building, designed in the style of a miniature Greek temple, is of all things the town fish market. Here the fishermen bring their catch, which can consist of an abundant variety. Anywhere from the small, colorful tropical ones to the large tuna, barracuda, kingfish, and sailfish. In fact, for anyone who enjoys the sport of fishing, Bonaire is certainly the place. Very little food is grown here and meat's quite expensive, so every day the townspeople gather to await the fishermen and their evening meal. One of the most interesting inhabitants here is Mr. Heitkernik, known as Heit. He makes jewelry from tortoiseshell. Many years ago, back in his native Holland, Heit was offered a job as a jewelry salesman over in Curaçao. Well, he took it, planning to stay only a year. But one weekend, he came over to Bonaire. Well, that was 22 years ago, and you know he's never been back to Holland since. It's very difficult to work with a hard tortoiseshell, and a lovely dresser set he made of a rare cherry tortoise sells for $100. One of the main places to stay here is a delightful rustic inn, the Flamingo Beach Club. Here one can rent the club's 40-foot catch for the day, or, if one prefers, swim at the club's own beach, a beach whose bathers appear quite routine. Or do they? This bather's name is Bubbles, the devoted pet of Mr. Heitkernig, who I'm sure is the only man in the world with a 165-pound pet loggerhead. Bubbles, who dearly loves swimming with Height and follows him around like a puppy, is a mere youngster of 8 and has many swimming years ahead of him, as his life expectancy is well over 100 years. The story of this strange friendship began when one day a newly hatched baby turtle waddled over to Height and enjoyed being petted by him. Well, as he grew, his devotion for Height grew. And as loggerheads are of the snapping, dangerous variety, this was certainly a devotion out of the ordinary. One day, Height decided to take Bubbles swimming with him to see if perhaps this turtle love would dissolve in the depths of the ocean. Instead, the turtle stayed right with him, came up for air when he did, and even swam ashore when he did. So now these improbable friends are a common sight in Bonaire. Not too far from the Flamingo Beach Club are the salt pans, and although little exploited now, they attest to the once thriving salt industry of the 17th and 18th centuries. Nearby are rows of stark slave huts, used to house the many slaves brought to work the salt pans. An average-sized man has difficulty in even entering, yet as many as 6 slaves used to be kept in one hut. Here, 2 picturesque pylons still stand that used to guide the salt ships to their moorings. Nearby in the Salt Lake is one of the only 7 natural breeding grounds in the entire world of rare pink flamingos. We were told that we might be able to see these beautiful birds out in the center of the shallow lake near their nests. Well, not keen on such a watery hike, but most anxious to see them, we splashed off in search of them. Unlike the tame flamingos generally seen, these birds are extremely shy and very difficult to approach. But soon we saw a group off in the distance. But when they saw us, off they flew. Although knee-deep in water, our hopes remained undampened as we carefully approached another group, but they too turned their backs on us and flew away. This sanctuary is so protected that even planes aren't allowed to fly over it. Finally, we were able to get fairly close to one, a young one, as his feathers hadn't turned pink yet. They don't for nearly a year. Luckily, he didn't see us. I guess he was too busy doing the flamingo twist. At last, we reached their nests after trudging through the water for 2 miles, but still no flamingos. Their mud nests are well elevated to keep the eggs dry, and the sun bakes them until they're firm enough to hold the egg and parent bird. To think there are almost 5,000 flamingos here, and we can't get a really good look at them. Before returning to shore, mission unaccomplished, we wearily made use of their nests. Empty ones, that is. Early the next morning, we set out again, and this time we were successful. What a rare sight! A whole group of wild flamingos at their nests. These birds are among the richest in color of the entire species. Their deep rosy hue is due to the microscopic red shrimp that they eat from the Salt Lake. That's the way we felt about it, too. Some of these babies are probably no more than a few hours old. Well, I think this one better wait until tomorrow to try his new little legs. This could be called Baby's First Steps. And from the looks of the next one, he must be pondering the old adage of which came first. As these graceful creatures flew away, so did we. Leaving Bonaire behind, we continued on to the island of Aruba, lying just 15 miles off the coast of Venezuela. Aruba is the smallest of the ABC group, but second in importance. And surprisingly, its airport is an important link in international air traffic. Sitting right out on a beautiful stretch of beach is the Aruba Caribbean Hotel. It's strikingly modern. And you know, it's a funny thing. The cars around here are appropriately the same identical color as the trim of the hotel. Well, I wonder in this case, who mixed the paint first? The hotel's 8 stories make it the tallest building in the entire Dutch West Indies. It was built several years ago by an American architect at a cost of $5 million and has played a very important part in bringing many more tourists to Aruba. A band that plays at the hotel is composed of a father and his 7 sons, ranging in age from 18 down to only 5, with sometimes even a younger conductor taking over. When the Caribbean moon comes up, so do the lights of the hotel's famous casino. And with the turning of the wheels, the guests gather, hoping to see Lady Luck turn in their direction. Well, it looks like she's turned toward him. The slot machines, or one-armed bandits as they're aptly called, aren't holding anyone up tonight. You know, this seems to always happen to the other person. Around the hotel, there's a living fence of cactus. And as Aruba, like Curaçao and Bonaire, is very dry, the cactus not only grows everywhere, but is also put to very practical use. With this unique clothesline, the cactus needles serve as the clothespins. But you know, with enough of this, I think the laundry could serve as a sieve as well. One of the most distinctive features of Aruba's fascinating landscape is the tree that grows sideways, enchantingly called the Divi-Divi tree. You'll never need your compass in Aruba, as the Divi-Divi tree is bent by the incessant trade winds to always point southwest. Aside from being a natural compass, the tree also has another use discovered by Jacob Henriques. Cutting down only the dead ones, he then proceeds through a great deal of work to turn the trunks of these trees into what has become known as Divi-Divi tables. Mr. Henriques, who is of Carib Indian descent, is a most artistic craftsman. He, as all the Arubans, especially likes the Divi-Divi tree, and one day he decided to try an experiment with one of them. First, he split the trunk, as he's doing here. Once split, he puts the sections out in the hot sun to thoroughly dry. The next step is to sand this unusually heavy hardwood until it's completely smooth. The only thing that he does to another wood that's used for the legs is wash it. His little girl watching him seems upset. She probably hopes she's not next to be scrubbed. With the application of the lacquer, 8 coats in all, the grain of this magnificent wood gradually comes more and more to life. Mr. Henriques, until a few years ago, was a shipbuilder, but he's become so successful in making these tables that now this is his full-time work. It takes about 2 weeks to complete a table. And depending on size, they cost anywhere from $75 to $125. After the finishing touches, he crates them and sends them off to the people who've ordered them, mostly people here in the United States. Two, you can see them in the Aruba Caribbean Hotel. Another artist of Aruba is John Pandelis, who one's liable to find almost anywhere around the island, busily painting the many subjects it has to offer. The strong trade wind whipping at him doesn't seem to deter him, but his dog, well, shall we say that he's a horse of another color? Could be that his dog, appropriately named Rembrandt, just wants to paint too. The moral to this story is don't take your dog painting. Well, all's forgiven, as Pandelis tries to finish his painting of a hex house. These hex houses are scattered throughout the countryside and are so called because of the tiles designed with hex signs that decorate the sides of the house. It's a superstition here that the hex signs ward off evil spirits. Work over, Pandelis walks home through the strange countryside, or Kanuku as it's called here too. He says it often gives him more ideas for paintings, such as the one he did of the only mountain in Aruba called the Haystack. It towers all of 450 feet. Fascinating rock formations and piles of huge boulders rear unaccountably from the earth. This, too, Pandelis has put on canvas. Nature's performed some remarkable feats here, such as this huge boulder balancing precariously, and other shapes, like this enormous flat iron, a hungry bear, and for those who are hungry, a hamburger. But to me, the best one of all is this huge stone turtle. In places, the weird landscape seems to resemble some prehistoric world or even another planet. Aruba is thought to be the top of a submerged mountain chain that ends in nearby Venezuela. This little chapel stands silently by itself on the deserted windward side of the island, along with ruins reminiscent of the times when Aruba was the center of the Spanish Main, teeming with pirates who held up the treasure ships laden with precious cargo. Pandelis' seascape captures the mood of the rugged windward side, where the sea constantly crashes against the coral rock. Here, too, the thundering surf has carved out this huge natural bridge, the largest formation of its kind in the Caribbean. In contrast is the placid leeward side of the island. Fabulous white beaches stretch along as far as the eye can see, and one certainly can't complain about crowds here. Aside from his own painting, Pandelis also conducts art classes, generally composed of some of the many Americans now living in Aruba. The subject matter for the day is the only natural vegetable garden on the island. Because of the dry land, a new method of soilless plant growing called nutriculture farming has been developed, and this is the nutriculture farm. Vegetables are grown in beds of gravel, by means of pumping water with just the proper amount of chemicals in it through the gravel. The same water can then be rechemicalized and used repeatedly. The manager proudly showed us some of the crop, which grows to king size. The yield per acre here is 20 times greater than that of an ordinary truck farm, which more than takes care of the 58,000 inhabitants of the island. Well, from the looks of these string beans, this must be where Jack and the Beanstalk came from. Where the Nutriculture Farm gets its water is an equally interesting technical development. At this $11 million plant, seawater is converted into fresh water. The water is brought in from the sea through these pipes, which in turn leads it to huge vats where the salt's boiled out of it. After other purifying steps, the water is then piped around the island at a rate of 3 million gallons a day. Little Aruba is more than proud of this plant, as it's the largest of its kind in the world. And the world's largest oil refinery belonging to Esso is here too, giving employment to 80% of the population. Pandelis even finds it an artistic subject to paint. The refinery, called the Lago Oil Company, maintains its own community, with schools, churches, a modern hospital, and many homes for its numerous American employees. Since it was first established here in 1928, it's brought great prosperity to the island. The refinery is also indirectly responsible for a form of entertainment, the steel band. The discarded oil drums are ingeniously turned into musical instruments, which produce a surprisingly mellow tone. The water is the small, neat capital of the island, Oranjestad, named after Holland's Royal House of Orange. Here, Pandellis leaves a cultural center in search of more subjects to paint in town. Often, too, he can be seen right on the town streets conducting his art classes. The official language of the entire Netherlands Antilles is Dutch, but the ABC group have an added language all their own, called Papiamento. Its recipe contains 2 cups of Spanish, 1 cup of Dutch, 1 teaspoon of French, 1 pinch of Portuguese, and 1 dash of English. The dash of English being the words okay and payday. Along Oranjestad's waterfront, schooners come again from South America to sell their food, which consists mainly of fish and fresh fruit. And in the marketplace, everyone searches for a bargain among the bananas. But instead of a bargain among the bananas, you're liable to find something quite different. Well, we've encountered many camera-shy people on our travels. Moored along the waterfront is a little houseboat, the home of a unique floating restaurant called the Ballet. We went in to have their specialty, Rijfstafel, a meal to have only when you're really hungry and not counting calories, as it consists of 20 to 40 different exotic Indonesian dishes. It takes 2 days to eat, prepare all the dishes, 2 hours to eat them, and I might add about 2 weeks of strenuous dieting afterwards. But now I wasn't thinking about those 2 weeks. I did that later. We were told that this was just the first group of dishes to be served. Well, you know, I couldn't believe it until they brought the second. Later, when we left, the owner was outside to greet us. Or was it to congratulate us? Along with wooden shoes and windmills, another thing typically Dutch is the barrel organ. This one has been imported straight from Holland and is accompanying a most unusual dance, typical only of Aruba. At first glance, you may think this just an ordinary maypole dance, but on closer inspection, you'll see it's much more than that. It's a maypole dance, but done with a Roomba beat. The rhythm's accentuated by scraping a piece of ridged metal called a wiri. This is the most important instrument in this part of the world. This dance is only done on very special occasions. Today, they're celebrating the birthday of a member of Holland's royal family, Princess Beatrix. Footsteps in the sand quickly disappear. Nothing can dispel the charm of these 3 islands, so truly a tropical touch of the Dutch. Thank you. Now, after the intermission, Lisa Chickering will be back to take you on the second half of our trip. Thank you.